Well, welcome back, everyone, to True Crime on Easy Street. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
It is 2022. Can you believe that we've been doing this for most of a year already? I mean, this we decided we're officially going to call this season two.
This is season correct? Two.
Season welcome. Two starts today.
Today, right now.
Take off your party hats. We're going back to work, everybody. Listen up. This is going to get shit nuts.
And I wore my lounge suit today.
I was not going to mention that, but I'm glad that you did.
Crushed velvet, relaxation, lounge suit.
Very nice.
Oh, it's so soft.
Oh, it is soft.
And it's so cold outside.
It is so cold. I'm very jealous
of
your attire.
It's perfect. I'm so comfortable right now.
It was 75 degrees in Center Alabama on Saturday afternoon, and it is currently right now Monday afternoon at 5:32 p.m.
The temperature
PM.
Is...
34, according to my phone.
There you go. I was going to say, drum roll.
Yeah. So, screw this.
People who live in Alabama for the first time right now, who just recently moved, are thinking it's apocalyptic.
Yeah. No, this like this all the time. You have all four seasons in a weekend. It's how it works here. There was snow on my back porch. On the mattress, on the cushions on my lounge chair when I woke up this morning. I guess maybe it was sleet, not snow, but.
Man, I think there were some flurries I could see out the window last night, in the middle of the night, but nothing really stuck at our house.
I met a truck on the road on the way to work at 8:30 this morning that had at least 3 inches of white powder on the hood. So I don't know if he was up in one of the higher elevations. We have some of those here in the county. Even though we have a lake, we also have mountain areas. So maybe he was up 1,500 feet higher than I was last night. But yeah, like 3 or 4 inches of the white powder. And I mean the cold kind, the kind that falls from the sky, not the other, not the kind that comes up from Central America. Anyway, there was some
allegedly,
of that.
Allegedly.
So yeah, it was cold.
Yeah.
And it still is.
By the way, I'm Kelly Turner and I'm still not a doctor in 2022.
My name is Scott Wright and I'm a mediocre journalist.
And I'm Katie Givens and I'm not a lawyer.
We almost forgot to do that. And that's our whole gag. I mean, a lot of people just stop listening after that. After they hear us do that, they're like, okay, I heard him do it.
And
turning it off.
Now I can tell them that I listened.
Yeah.
So we're going to start putting that at the end. We're smarter than
you. No. We should always do it at the beginning.
Happy New Year. Welcome to season two.
Well,
I want to tell everybody about what a great time Katie had on New Year's Eve, but she's looking at me like I should not do that. But listen, she had a great time. We all did. A bunch of us spent the night, we spent our evening. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it right still. We had a good time until it was time to leave on New Year's Eve at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall and Center. Shane Givens, the band, played, and everybody had a really good time.
I think I won.
Was told. I think Katie
I think
might
I got
have.
The medal.
Yeah, Katie got the gold medal on having
Sweet.
A good time. So.
She won the one New Year's Eve.
She had a great time, and we all did. So yeah, a great time. First ever New Year's Eve at Easy Street Restaurant, Bar, and Performance Hall. We're going to do it all again next year. We're going to try to figure out some way to get that 50-inch disco ball outside on a crane and literally drop it like they do at Times Square in New York City.
I foresee it busted. And
a disaster. It's going to be a ginormous disaster. We're going to have to,
that makes me
we're
so
gonna
nervous.
Have to get involved with a mattress outlet and have them bring a ton of mattresses to put under it just in case we have a problem with the crane. But we'll solve that problem. We have 363 days to solve that problem.
Yep.
Moving along.
Well, okay. What year are you taking us to, Scott?
Yeah. Are you going to set the table?
I am, and the crime that we're going to talk about tonight, does anybody know what we're talking about? I guess if you're listening to this, you've read the title, and Katie always does a fantastic job with the titles. I don't know what she's going to do with it yet, but I'm sure it'll be fantastic. And so we're going to go to the year 1985 is when this case takes place, and there was I'll let you guys get into the specifics, but it was 85 and a really cool year. I was 15 years old in 1985, or at least I was on March the 20th of that year. But before that happened, on January the 1st, the Internet domain name system was created on January the 1st of that year. 27 days later, the charity single record We Are the World was recorded by USA for Africa. The song was written by Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie, an Alabama native.
What a great song.
If you folks out there didn't know that, sold over 20 million copies. It was recorded on January the 28th that year in Los Angeles.
Love that song.
Love the video, love the song. I couldn't believe that my favorite rock and roller of the time, Huey Lewis, actually made the list of people who got invited to sing on it, but I was very excited when he got like, you know, four words at the end of one of the choruses. I was very excited. On March the 31st of 1985, the inaugural WrestleMania event was held at Madison Square Garden, and Hulk Hogan teamed with Mr. T. Wow, we're all dating ourselves now, or at least I am, in the main event against Paul Orndorff and Rowdy Roddy Piper. That was the big event.
I know all of these people but one.
Orndorff?
I don't know that person.
Yeah. If you were a wrestling fan when I was 15 years old in 1985, that was awesome.
Okay.
It was the main event for a reason. That was huge.
It sounds like it.
I don't remember who won. It doesn't matter. I'm sure it was predetermined before it all got started. In April of 1985, Coca-Cola changed its formula and released New Coke.
Ugh.
And that lasted for 3 months almost to the day, and then they shit canned it and brought back Old Coke.
That was a disaster.
Big time. On May the 16th of 1985, scientists of the British Antarctic Survey realized that there was a ginormous hole in, wait for it, the ozone layer. Remember that when that was a big thing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it still is anymore. Are we out of ozone? I'm still breathing.
It's still there. But the hole's still there.
The hole's still there. It's got to be, right? But anyway, that's when that happened. And then on June the 27th, U.S. Route 66 was officially decommissioned. It's still there. You can still traverse it, but it's not the way that AAA tells you how to get from Chicago to Santa Monica anymore. Now there's interstate.
Mm-hmm. And it's probably quicker, isn't it?
Lots quicker. Yeah. Two-lane roads, red lights. The section that I traveled a few years ago with friends, it's not the easiest or most efficient way to go from east to west. 6 days later, Back to the Future opened at American Theaters on July 3rd.
Song? Back in Time?
He did. That's the same Huey Lewis, my favorite rock and roller as a child. And he actually had a cameo in the film. If you remember, when Marty goes up onto the stage at the beginning of the film to try out his band for the New Year's Eve celebration.
Yes.
The person who stands up with a megaphone and says, "You're too loud, go away."
That is him.
That's Huey Lewis.
That is. You're right.
And I've actually seen him live once.
I love
recently
that part too.
Very excited about that. On August the 31st, to get back sort of into our wheelhouse here, Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker.
I was about to say
Ramirez? In our true crime thing.
Okay, gotcha.
He was captured in Los Angeles. That spree lasted from June of 84 until August of 85 when he was caught.
Have you seen that video of the people just like beating the crap out of him in the...
No, but good for them.
Well, I mean, there's like a movie recreation, or maybe there was a documentary or something.
There was a group of people who accosted him.
Oh my gosh. Beat the crap out of him.
Well, they didn't get the job finished because he wasn't convicted for four more years of 13 murders and 11 sexual assaults, but he died in prison of cancer in 2013. Womp, womp, womp. Not sad about that.
That neighborhood was not sad about that.
The very next day, they found the Titanic in the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Dr. Robert Ballard, in 12,500 feet of water and 370 miles from the coast of Newfoundland, found the Titanic the very next day.
They just took that off Netflix, and Ellison was trying to get us to watch it, and we were like, no, we do not have 3 hours right now. And she's like, have they found the Titanic? We're like, yes. I didn't know it was
The original film. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the film
nobody found Leo, though. He's still
floated
to the bottom of
Rose.
I don't even know. Was it Jack? I don't even know what his name was.
Speaking of Rose, 10 days later, Pete Rose became the all-time hit leader in Major League Baseball history with his 4,192nd hit at Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati, his home stadium.
All right.
So set the Major League record. In October, the first Nintendo home video game console in the United States was released. It was called the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES. Mm-hmm. And just the previous month, Super Mario Brothers had been released. So that was done on purpose in advance of the Christmas holidays.
It was a little gray box, and you flipped it up.
Yep.
And you put the movie
The cartridge in. Uh-huh. The cartridge. And, mm-hmm. and you played Mario Brothers and not much else at the time. But it ended up being one of the biggest video games consoles of all. It really, the Atari systems had kind of faded away, but Nintendo found their second wind. Mm-hmm. In November on the 18th, the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes was published for the very first time. One of my favorite all-time comic strips. In December on the 16th, again, in our wheelhouse here in this true crime genre that we do.
Okay.
In New York City, American Mafia bosses Paul Castellano and Thomas Bilotti were shot dead in front of Sparks Steakhouse, a famous landmark in New York City, if you ever decide to go there. Keep your head on a swivel, just in case. But that made Paul, John Gotti, the leader of the Gambino crime family. And he had another 5 years in charge of the entire operation before he was convicted of multiple mafia-related crimes, including 5 murders, and he was sentenced to life without parole and died in prison of cancer in 2002. I hope I'm not spoiling a future episode. No. Maybe nobody will be listening. And lastly, on December the 31st, American singer-songwriter and actor Ricky Nelson passed away in a plane crash. He was leaving, and I did not know this until 5 hours ago, he was leaving Guntersville, Alabama, which is about 45 minutes from here, as the crow flies, headed to Dallas to do a New Year's Eve concert. And he and the other 6 passengers in the back of the plane all perished. The 2 pilots survived. And that is everything interesting and that happened in 1985.
That's 1985, what? Oh, except what we're going to talk about.
Except for what we're going
to
talk about.
Yeah, there's some interesting things. But one thing that we've got to talk about that's present day, it's not 1985 related.
1985. Wait, I just did Bowling for Soup. I'm sorry.
2021 related. Betty White.
I don't want to talk about it.
I knew where that was going.
I don't want to talk about it. What a slap in the face to humanity. That Betty White died at 99 years old on December the 31st. She was going to turn 100 on January the 17th. The TV networks already have 100-year-old happy birthday specials planned, which I assume that they will still run.
People Magazine already put out there.
She was on the cover. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As she deserves to
Up
be.
Up yours, world.
I
for
love
taking
her.
Betty White from us. And I said the same thing a few days ago in a bar. I was like, I can't believe that Betty White died. And somebody grabbed me by the arm and said, how can you not believe she died? She was 99 years old. And I said, let me put this into context for you. She was in good health. She was very excited about turning 100. All the networks were on board. But, you know, we can't control those things. So
now when you're 99
but
years old.
But it's not like she was in the hospital on a respirator. She
died at home. Yeah. I feel like, I really hope that it was very peaceful and in her sleep. And
same.
That's
and
how
I
like to
and nobody
it.
Has, Betty I haven't read anywhere.
Betty's such an icon and she deserves nothing less than to just peacefully, you know, drift away.
I
feel like if you're 99 years old, I mean, a really like a sudden sneeze or a bad fart could do it. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like
God, I
you're
hope not.
99. I'm not trying to be. I'm
hope
saying
not.
People's and it just shows how amazing she was when you said Betty White passed away and people were like, why? What happened?
Yeah. It's like,
well,
no.
She was 99. Yeah. But what happened? Mm-hmm. What? Thought I explained it. I mean, you know, but that just shows you. She was taken from us way too soon at 99 years old.
Yeah, there's a great political cartoon that I saw this afternoon. The cartoonist Truett, she's at the pearly gates. And St. Peter says, wow, he's looking down at his paperwork and he says, wow, it really says something about you when you're 99 years old and the world is mad that we've taken you.
Uh-huh.
So
does
yeah,
it not?
That.
Okay, so Betty White, just had to say it one more time.
Wow, thanks for bringing us down.
I know. I love her so much.
Yeah, I did too.
All right. So go ahead, Katie.
Well, it says something when Scott says that's bringing us down, not the horrific crime we're going to talk about next.
I mean, really.
I realized as soon as I said that somebody was going to take that and run with it. I thought it would be you and not Katie, but here we are.
Yep.
All right.
So we're back to, we're going to go. You took us to 1985 and you set the table really nicely. Thank you so much for that. I'm going to back up just a little bit though. But our crime takes place in 1985. I'm going to get us there. Trust me. But let me take you on a journey to Beatrice, Nebraska. And no, I'm not mispronouncing it. We would call this Beatrice here in the state, the great state of Alabama. But in Nebraska, they say Beatrice.
It's true.
Beatrice is a very small town of about 12,000 people located in Gage County. And in many ways, Beatrice is like our little small town here. Everyone knows everyone pretty much. Crime is relatively low. Although after listening to our podcast in season one, you might not think that the crime right here is low.
True.
But in relation to the grand scheme of things, Beatrice is it's similar to where we reside. Something interesting happened on March 1st, 1950 in Beatrice, Nebraska, and it was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, the older version, not the rebooted version.
Like with Robert Stack back in the 80s.
With the great.
I got you. The great Robert Stack.
Yes, himself. So on March 1st, 1950, there was a church choir was supposed to have practice. It was scheduled at Westside Baptist Church in Beatrice. The leader of the choir was Martha Paul, had been the leader of the choir for 30 years, was very diligent about being on time. Everybody get there on time. We got to practice. It was on Wednesday night, and it started at 7:20 p.m. every Wednesday.
All right.
Okay. At 7:25 p.m., there was a huge explosion that shattered windows from houses nearby. It caused a power outage. The church exploded. And it destroyed the entire structure of the church. Just gone. Exploded. So what they think happened was the reverend lit the coal furnace about 5:30 p.m. to get everything warm and ready for church choir practice.
Oh,
at 7:20.
Okay, because if you start talking about a church exploding, if you live in Alabama, you think that
it was about a hate crime.
It was a black church, and a bunch of KKK members had something to do with it.
Yeah,
but this is not that.
No.
Oh, well, good.
So the reverend, he lights the coal furnace at about 5:30 for the choir, and then the authorities were thinking that maybe it was like a broken pipe that leaked gas into the church and then caused the explosion. The explosion killed exactly zero people. And that's because all 15 members of the choir who were supposed to be there on time,
right,
rehearsing, for whatever reason, all of them were running late.
That sounds like the way we do things here at True Crime on Easy Street.
That is insane.
Yes. Yeah. The chances are, I think it's in 1 million to 1. Yeah. Most people arrived there about 7:15 for rehearsal. And so it goes into a breakdown of exactly why every single person was running late. We had a couple of high school students working on geometry. We had some others, they were listening to a radio show, because remember it was 1950 and it wasn't over till 7:30.
Sure.
The person who played the piano took a nap after dinner and woke up too late. Two other choir members couldn't get their cars to start. One was just feeling lazy and just didn't leave as early as usual. Then there was another guy who was taking care of his children because his wife was away. And he thought about bringing his kids, but he lost track of time and was like, forget it. We're late. We're not going to show up late.
Okay.
And so every single one survived. 1 in 1 million chance that everybody would survive that. And they did.
And the preacher wasn't there.
The preacher was not there. He lit the fire and left.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Well, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's more than 1 million. It's a lot. If I remember how to, anyway, it's a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot.
For 15 people to all have some reason to not show up, that's 15 times 14 times 13 times 12, all the way down.
Those odds.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's in the billions.
And I don't know exactly what episode it is on Unsolved Mysteries, but it aired in 1990, and I'm sure you could just do a quick little Google and find that. And see that whole thing. And it'll take you through the whole process. But that is very interesting. But that's not what we're talking about today. What we're going to talk about occurred in 1985. And I promise you, I'm going to get to 1985. Okay? But first, I'm going to start the summer of 1983.
Okay.
In the summer of 1983, there were a series of attacks on single elderly women. The first one happened in June. A 73-year-old woman was attacked by a man wearing a stocking over his face. So she's sitting in her chair, and she looks up, and there's a man with a stocking over his face.
He holds in her house?
Yes, in her house. He holds a knife to her throat. He tries to rape her. She fights him off by kicking him in the groin. Good for her.
Yeah.
Hope she got a really good shot. And he fled. The second attack occurred in August of 1983, an 82-year-old woman was attacked by a man with a terry cloth mask over his face. She was able to give them a little bit of information. Had longer blonde hair. He tried to strangle her, but she fought him off, and he fled. She's 82 years old. Then there was another one in August. A 71-year-old woman was attacked in bed by a man she described as a thin young man that had long blonde hair. She's lying in bed. All of a sudden, the light in her bedroom is flipped on. There's this man standing there, and he tries to attack her. Now, she fought him off. She did receive a cut to her throat and on her arms, and he did manage to punch her in the face before she got away. But all three of these attacks were unsuccessful. And they occurred within blocks of an attack that unfortunately was successful on February the 6th, 1985. So there was a two-year break there, almost a two-year break. And then February the 6th, 1985, Helen Wilson, who was 68 years old, lived in an apartment. She lived in apartment number 4 by herself in the downtown area of Beatrice across from Charles Park. This is on 212 North 6th Street. She was the mother of 3, the grandmother of 7, and the great-grandmother of 6. At 68, that seems pretty young to be a great grandmother. I'm sure doing math is not my thing, but I'm sure you do the math and it works out. But at the time, Helen was sick. She had pneumonia, and her relatives were caring for her since she lived alone. So that night, her relatives stayed with her in her apartment until about 9:45 p.m., and she told them as they were leaving that she was going to go to bed. Mm-hmm. Oh, Scott's phone just went.
Mom, it's always Mom who calls on Monday. I told her a million times, don't call Monday from 5 to 7. We're doing something.
Oh, hi,
almost
Mom.
Almost every week.
Don't be rude to Mom.
I'm not. I'll call her later.
Okay. All right, so Helen is in her apartment. She's sick. Her relatives are taking care of her. At 9:45, they leave, and she says she's going to bed because she has pneumonia. She's not feeling well.
Mm-hmm.
So later that evening, they try to call her. The calls go unanswered. They chalk it up that she's asleep. The next morning, her sister shows up to check on her because they've tried to call her in the morning time,
right,
and they've not heard from her. And her sister found Helen dead in her apartment. Helen had been raped and suffocated. So I'm going to take you through the crime scene. There were obvious signs of a break-in. The door was pried open. They believe the attack started in the bedroom and ended up in the living room where she was found. Her hands were bound with a towel from her own apartment, and her face was covered with a scarf or an afghan. I've seen both.
Mm-hmm.
Tied around her neck and head. Whichever it was, the scarf, the afghan, whatever, all of that, the towel, all that was from her apartment. So nothing was brought into the crime scene.
Okay. I think I see where you're going with that.
Yeah. Her nightgown was lifted up. Obviously, I said she had been raped. She had a broken breastbone, a broken arm, and several broken ribs.
Ugh.
There was a lot of physical evidence here at the crime scene. There was semen on her body, on the carpet near where her body was laying, and on her nightgown. So DNA everywhere. There was also blood on her gown and her bed. They found fingerprints in her apartment that did not match hers. Of course, they're going to rule out family members, things right, like that. And they realize we have a set of fingerprints here that we can't account for. A knife was found that had Helen's fingerprints and other fingerprints on it that did not belong to Helen. So there is our weapon that they believe was used to, held to her throat, possibly.
To intimidate her.
Exactly, right. To control her, the knife. And that knife came from her kitchen. There was cash found in the apartment and valuables all left there. There were signs of a struggle, but there had not been signs of like someone ransacked the place. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no drawers pulled open and crap thrown everywhere and valuables missing. I mean, there's 12, it was either $1,200 or $1,300 worth of cash.
Yeah.
In a drawer in her apartment that easily could have been found. It's a small apartment.
Yeah.
She had several valuables there. None of that had been taken. The blood at the scene was determined to be type B blood. So that's not a common blood type.
I'm B negative, and I think that's like 3% of the population.
It's a rare blood type. So B blood, which narrows down our pool of who could have done this.
Remember that.
And this person was determined to be a non-secretor. So you have as I understand it, and I have a very basic understanding of this.
Wait, are you a doctor?
No.
Okay.
Not a doctor. So you can be a secretor or a non-secretor. Two types. Mm-hmm. Apparently this person was type B and a non-secretor, and apparently this is very rare. I'm told.
Does that mean that the identifying markers in your blood are not left in your saliva or other bodily fluids like your tears or semen?
Is that not
semen?
The same as B positive and B negative?
I have no idea. I'm not a doctor.
yeah, again, not a doctor. And I looked it up and I couldn't get a...
We don't use this anymore.
It's not a word. It's not a phrase not a lot used
that
anymore.
It's not a lot that you can find on this.
Got it.
I'm sure we could contact Dr. Clint Allen and find the out.
Let me write down.
So, Sky, there's some
right
homework
now.
Before our next
call
week's
Dr.
episode.
Allen.
Okay.
Before next Monday.
Yeah.
And we will find out.
Ask
what's
him
going
the
on.
Difference in a secretor and a non-secretor.
Done.
So apparently the attacker was type B blood and a non-secretor. Mm-hmm. The fuse box in the apartment building had been tampered with to turn off the lights in the building. And so what does that tell us? You gotta know the building a little bit, right?
You think so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the victim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're thinking, okay, this was a targeted thing. There were signs of necrophilia involved in this crime. And I'm sorry to get so detailed, but here's what they think. They don't think that the necrophilia was intentional because Helen had pneumonia and the stuff had been tied over her face. They believe that she actually died during the attack,
like
because she was unable to breathe
sure.
because of the pneumonia and died. Suffocated to death while being raped. Can I just say that?
Yeah.
Because that's what happened to this poor
That's what
woman.
Happened to this poor grandmother of six and great-grandmother of seven or whatever those numbers were.
Yes. So, and it was a brutal crime. Many bone fractures. But they did not believe that murder was actually the motive. They believed that the rape was the motive. Rape and leave. Mm-hmm. They actually do not think that the person meant to kill her.
Got you.
So the scarf suffocated her, like I said, likely due to her pneumonia. And of course, then it was either the Afghan. One of the two was tied around her neck and then the other was laid on top. There was, you know, her face was covered. Okay. So the Beatrice Police Department is going to take this case, and they're going to Police Chief Don Luckenroth and Detective Sam Stevens are going to work this case. Early information that they have from that crime scene that is going to lead them to several persons of interest. Mm-hmm. The first person of interest is someone by the name of Bruce Smith. He's a drifter and one-time resident of Beatrice who moved away and was back in town during February of 1985. He's the first suspect. And they're going to name him as the first person of interest in March of 1985. So pretty quick.
All right.
This happened in February. By March, they're going to say, we're really interested in Bruce Smith. So they get a story from someone who says he was in town. He was at a bar with Bruce. And Bruce would not stop talking about wanting to get laid that night.
Yeah.
They go to this after party. They end up crashing at this place. With these two girls in the middle of the night, one of the girls gets very upset because Bruce tries to attack her, tries to rape her in the middle of the night. And she basically kicked his ass, like kicked his ass and kicked him out.
Good for her.
And so the informant drives Bruce somewhere else in the middle of the night and drops him off. And so the police find Bruce and they talk with him. He admits to being in town and just says, hey, it was all a big misunderstanding. He freely offers blood sample and fingerprints. And the blood type comes back and says, okay, Bruce, you are type B, but Bruce is a secretor. So he's ruled out. So they get many, many more tips that are coming in from people all over, you know, small town, and you get all of these stories. They end up looking into 62 other men. So they're working this case. 62 other men.
The local police department is doing its job.
They are. This is the police department. And so they're, you know, they will look into a man and they'll say, hey, we need your blood and your fingerprints. And they collect all these and they're just not finding a match. They're not finding who's doing this. So the family in June of 1985, they're going to establish a reward fund to try and find the killer because they're wanting to amp this up. It's June. Our loved one was killed in February. We want to speed this up. So how about some reward money? So they put up some reward money and then other people start adding to it. And so it builds up to about $3,500, which is a good bit of money in June of 1985.
Sure.
I mean, it's a good bit of money today.
Yeah.
But I mean, in 1985 is even more money. Even I don't more. Know. I don't know how to work that and inflation yes. and all that. Probably, whatever.
I don't want
to
know.
That's probably $12,000-$15,000 in today's money back in 1985.
Probably.
At least. Somebody exactly. do the math and text us, but it's got to be it's got to be a lot.
Yeah. So the police department, they're going to bring in the FBI because they need help. And so they're very open to working with other sources. And you know, sometimes in cases, the police department, they just want to work it themselves. They don't want to bring anybody else in. That's not the case here.
Well, you would hope that a small department in a small city like Beatrice would realize, hey, we're not qualified to do this. Let's bring in the professionals. Let's call the Nebraska State Police. Let's call the FBI. Let's give them a chance to come in and look at all of this evidence.
We need some help here.
They look at it all. This is what they do. We handle 3 murders a year.
Right.
They do this all day, every day.
Very small town, 12,000 people.
Let's bring in the pros.
Low crime rate. So the FBI is going to send Special Agent Peter Klismet, and he's going to put together a profile. I'm going to read you the FBI profile from Peter Klismet from straight from his book, FBI Diary, Profiles of Evil. So this is an excerpt. Here is our profile of our perpetrator. He will be a white male in his late teens or early 20s. He was and probably still is described as a nice, quiet, and shy boy. He is thin and of average to below average height. The suspect lives close to Mrs. Wilson's apartment because all of the similar attacks occurred within a 4-block area. In addition, he will probably live with his mother or another older female relative. He is very dependent on his mother or a mother figure in his life, and has been dominated by her throughout his life. He resents this domination and has had significant conflict with either this woman or another significant woman in his life. The suspect likely has a poor self-image and low self-esteem. He wouldn't be comfortable in a relationship with a woman his own age. In school, he would have been seen as a loner or, at the very least, odd. He would have been involved in activities and probably would have been of slightly below average intelligence. He would care little about personal hygiene. He is not someone women would be attracted to. His car, if he owns one, would have been drab and old and probably unkept inside and poorly maintained. It's also possible he knew Mrs. Wilson and may have performed errands or work for her in the past. The likelihood that he had been in her apartment previously cannot be discounted. There is even a possibility that the suspect lived in the apartment building at one time. The suspect has, in all probability, been interviewed early in the investigation. He may have approached the police under the guise of a concerned citizen or may have provided information to take the focus away from himself. The suspect was motivated by rape and probably did not mean to kill Mrs. Wilson. It is probable the suspect will have a past record of sexual assault. As a result, he may have felt remorseful and may have visited her grave in an effort to make peace with himself and minimize the stress he felt. Peter Klismet goes on to say that the attacks from 1983 and this attack are directly related. He's saying that it is the same person.
Yeah,
and he is saying, it is without a doubt, I have no doubt in my mind, he says, that it is one perpetrator.
A lone perpetrator is what the FBI profiler thinks.
This is what he comes up with after getting all the case files from the police chief and reading them for hours. And he comes up with this profile he may, I don't know how many hours or how long he read this, but he spent some time in Beatrice. And that's what he comes up with.
Well, if you ever saw, if you guys have seen, is it Mindhunter on Netflix?
Yes.
That 3-season series that kind of tells, it's a fictionalized version of how that FBI crime unit comes into being back in the, what is that, the late 60s, early 70s when Zodiac is around. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the more you watch it, the more you kind of scratch your head and go, oh yeah, that makes perfect sense too. Well, because all of those guys, all those serial killers basically fit a relatively narrow profile. And I don't know that how much you can extrapolate that into a series of rapes, but yeah, a lot of similarities. And it seems like a lot of those similarities are reflected in Klismet's profile.
Well, Mindhunter was a book that was written by John Douglas Mark Olshaker. Is that how you say it? Olshaker?
Sure. Yeah.
Anyways, they write this book because of their years of FBI profiling. Mm-hmm. So
they created the
show.
Unit.
Yeah. The show is fictional, but it's based on a book that is nonfiction.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting.
But if you're interested in how, if all of that sounded like BS to you, watch some of these series, read some of these books that are based on fact, and you'll realize that a lot of, there are those similarities. It is, in a general sense, easy to pick out who these people are because they all fit the same.
Well, and they don't arrive at this. They don't just get a summary, kind of like we're telling you the summary, and then they come up with this. They read the case file numerous times. They are trained. They're not just, in the FBI, you don't just know how to do this because you're in the FBI. You have to be specially trained after you get into the FBI and be an FBI profiler. And this particular FBI agent, Peter Klismet, was fresh out of being trained. So this was one of his first, I don't know if it wasn't actually his first, but one of his first few profiles that he puts together after being trained in how to do this. So there's a lot that goes into it. And if you want to know how all that works, you can read Mindhunter. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. And I would suggest you read Peter Klismet's book. And it's going to be, we're going to reference it in the show notes. Yes. It doesn't just cover the Beatrice case. It covers all the cases that he has been involved with. So it's really interesting book. So I really like it.
A comprehensive reflection on his entire career as an FBI.
Because he's now
profiler.
Retired.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then the other book that you mentioned, Scott, that is also going to be in our show notes that we would recommend you reading. Tell the name of that again, Scott.
I can. I threw my phone on the floor when my mother called.
It was Failure of Justice by John Farrakh.
Is it Farrakh or Farrakh? However we want to say it.
F-E-R-A-K.
Yeah.
If you want to look it up on Amazon.
It's a good, and it is only on this case.
Yeah, it deals specifically with the Beatrice 6.
Goes into a lot of detail.
Right.
So, right. Okay. So we get this profile, and in the meantime, the police are working this case. They're getting this profile. They're looking into these 62, 63 men. I'm going to introduce another character. Hmm. Bert Searcy. They call him Bert Searcy. S-E-A-R-C-E-Y. So Searcy, however you want to say it. We've been saying Searcy. Burdette Bert Searcy was born in 1948. His family had a successful grain elevator business for Gage and other counties in Nebraska. Remember, Beatrice is in Gage County. When he graduated high school, he worked on the farm. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a farming community. I mean, that's if you've seen
they had a successful
pictures
business.
Of what Beatrice looks like, it's as flat as a pancake for as far as you can see in any direction. Cornfields, don't forget it's Nebraska. And so, you know.
Yep.
That's why those people are there. They have to come to town and get supplies. Mm-hmm. And that's why Beatrice exists.
Right. So when he graduates high school, he works on the farm. And when he was in his late 20s, he was getting tired of that farming life. So he becomes obsessed with the show Starsky and Hutch. Who are Starsky and Hutch, Scott?
Starsky and Hutch was a 1970s hour-long crime drama. It imagine Dukes of Hazzard, but Bo and Luke had badges. Pretty much. They had a hot car. It was a Ford Torino that was red with a white stripe down the side. And the big thing every episode that you always looked for was for them to begin the chase of a suspect, and one of them, whoever was in the passenger seat, would reach out and put the big, huge red gumball light on the top of the car with a magnetic bottom so that it stayed. And so they chased, and then Huggy Bear was the local pimp who was their secret informant. I don't know how long that remained a secret. I hope it's not too soon for me to spill that. But yeah, it was back in the day when crime shows and shows in general on television had a hot car element. I mean, Magnum PI, Simon and Simon, and a PI. It was easy to create a fictional narrative every week.
Yeah, I absolutely love Simon and Simon.
Yeah, same here. That's my ringtone on my phone, the theme song from Simon and Simon to this day.
So Bert, he loves Starsky and Hutch. And Starsky and Hutch was, the show was serious. The yes. movie remake...
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
a comedy.
Yeah, with Luke Wilson and Ben Stiller.
And it's pretty
And I think Snoop Dogg played
I love
Huggy
that
Bear. So yeah. that's
So the movie sort of made fun of the show.
Yeah.
And it was, but the show was serious. So when Bert Searcy would have been watching this, it was a very serious show and he loved it. So he applied and was hired to the Beatrice Police Department as a city patrol officer in 1977. He often butted heads with our chief, remember, Don Luckenroth.
I'm glad you remembered because I did not write that down.
And he leaves the Beatrice Police Department in 1982, sour grapes. He just quits the profession altogether. He goes back to farm life. He buys all these acres. He's raising hogs. And then Helen Wilson is murdered. And this death... In 1985, February the 6th. And so he's, at this time, he's been out for a few years.
Yeah.
Out of the profession. No more badge, no nothing. And he hears about this and he immediately becomes intrigued. And he wants to be a part of this investigation. So he learns about this murder. He's talking to people around town. He's trying to insert himself into the investigation, and he contacts the family to offer his services.
And he knows members of the Wilson family.
He does. Right? It's a small town.
Yeah.
And, right. and they know him. He identifies himself as a private investigator when he contacts the family. However, according to both of my book sources, they constantly remind you that he is not a private investigator. He did not obtain that licensure, right, according to those two books.
He just thought that he was grandfathered in because he had 5 years in the Beatrice Police Department.
I guess, as a city patrol officer.
All right.
So, Searcy becomes a deputy for the Gage County Sheriff's Office in 1986. So, Helen Wilson's murders in 85 and 86, he's going to become a part of the county sheriff's department. And he tries to get back involved with the Beatrice Police Department, but he ends up getting involved with the sheriff's office. They have just recently elected a new sheriff. I believe it said, my book said November.
Sounds right. Yeah,
of 86.
Sure. Generally speaking, elections would take place.
And then... This new sheriff, I believe his name is DeWitt, hires Searcy. Okay. Yeah,
brings him back on.
Yeah, brings him into the sheriff's office. So remember, at the time, the Burdett Police Department is working this case, not the actual sheriff's office, Gage County Sheriff's Office. Gotcha. Okay. So once Searcy becomes a deputy in the sheriff's office, he's immediately wanting to pursue this case. He is interviewing people left and right. He's talking to people. He wants to take this case away from the Beatrice Police Department. He's very frustrated. He wants this case solved. So he starts talking to people around town, and he begins talking with someone he calls informant number one is Lisa Podendorf. So Lisa Podendorf tells him a story that he is going to use, and he's going to take it and he's going to run with it, and he's going to try to create a narrative around her story. Now, if you'll remember back to Detective Stevens from the Beatrice Police Department, who worked this case from the time it happened in 1985, he says to Searcy and to the sheriff's office, be careful with Lisa Podendorf. She is not a reliable source. She is not an honest person. We have talked with her many times, and we cannot, what is the word I'm trying to say?
Corroborate.
Corroborate.
Anything.
Thank you. That's a big word, Scott. That's a $10 word.
If I hadn't seen it said four times today in a documentary that I watched, I probably would have screwed it up.
So Detective Stevens is saying we can't bring any kind of light or truth to anything that she's been telling us. So watch out interviewing her. Searcy is not listening. And so he continues with informant number one, Lisa Podendorf. And he also says he has many, many other informants and he won't name. So he develops a wild theory of ripped $5 bills. He somehow convinces five people to admit their involvement in this crime. Those five people will go on to incriminate another person, bringing our total to six. And spoiler alert, they all get convicted and sent to jail in what some have called the biggest miscarriage of justice in Nebraska history, and maybe even the U.S.
Is that a cliffhanger?
That's a cliffhanger.
Is that what we're doing?
Yeah.
This is the end of the damn show? What this are you doing?
This is the end.
Oh, my God.
This is part one of the Beatrice Six.
I'm as mad as Bo Jolly right now. If he's listening out there somewhere, Bo, I apologize. I had no idea this was going to be a two-parter. I'm totally kidding. I knew it was going to be.
Jamie Talent hates it.
He's so mad. Sorry, guys. We start off 2022 right with a cliffhanger, and we will see you back next week for the exciting conclusion of the Beatrice Six.
Good night, everybody.
That was awesome.
Hold on. Try that out. Oh, shit. Am I talking over the thing? I'm-